in the limelight.
The Biden administration has unnecessarily and often unlawfully jailed tens of thousands of asylum seekers, many of whom have suffered severe physical and psychological abuse and discrimination, according to a report published recently. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Brett Wilkins, journalist. This article is published under the heading Report Details Biden Administration's Cruel and Unnecessary Jailing of Asylum Seekers. Here's more on the issue. The Biden administration has unnecessarily and often unlawfully jailed tens of thousands of asylum seekers, many of whom have suffered severe physical and psychological abuse and discrimination, according to a report published recently. The Human Rights First HRF report entitled "I Am a Prisoner Here" offers a harrowing look inside the world's largest immigration detention system, one which the Biden administration uses to jail people seeking refugee protection. HRF interviewed across scores of asylum seekers and collected information on hundreds of others jailed by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, DHS, many of whom reported sexual, physical, and verbal abuse, punitive use of solitary confinement, denials of basic necessities, and medical neglect, among other mistreatment. Jailing asylum seekers is inhumane, unnecessary, and wasteful, the report notes, adding, moreover, the mass detention of asylum seekers violates U.S. legal obligations under the Refugee Convention and its protocol. In its guidelines on the use of detention, the U.N. Refugee Agency, UNHCR, states that asylum seekers should not be detained and that the use of detention is, in many instances, contrary to the norms and principles of international law. The publication notes that President Joe Biden pledged to eliminate prolonged detention and the use of for-profit immigration detention centers and uphold the legal right to seek asylum. Yet to date, DHS under the Biden administration has detained tens of thousands of asylum seekers, jailing many in newly opened or expanded facilities or in remote areas where they often face insurmountable barriers to fairly presenting their asylum claims. According to the report, asylum seekers detained by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, include torture survivors, political dissidents, student organizers, human rights activists, and survivors of gender-based violence. The paper claims the Biden administration is using flood enforcement priorities that continue the failed approach of past administrations by targeting people requesting protection in the United States and jailing them for prolonged periods instead of allowing them to pursue their cases while living safely with their U.S. families and communities. One refugee fleeing death threats for his political activities told HRF, "I am a prisoner here. I would rather die in my country than be jailed here." Another asylum seeker said, "We came here to a country of law, but I found my brothers in tears. I don't know what to say. I did not expect this." Under the administration's enforcement priorities guidance, DHS has separated families seeking refugee at the border, illegally subjected children to detention in adult facilities, endangered many asylum seekers, and placed people with serious medical conditions at heightened risk during the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. The report notes that in October 2021, a Venezuelan asylum seeker died of complications from AIDS and COVID-19 after 5 months in detention. HRF also found racial disparities in the length of asylum seekers' detention. Overall, migrants tracked by HRF were jailed for an average of 3.7 months. People from the majority black countries, however, spent an average of 27% longer behind bars. The report details racist abuse by jailers, including towns about whipping detainees and their families like slaves and lynching them. While welcoming the administration's plan to end the deportation of migrants under Title 42, a public health provision first invoked by then-President Donald Trump under pretext of the COVID-19 pandemic, the report warns that DHS continued use of the flood enforcement priorities to jail asylum seekers as more are finally able to access U.S. asylum processes threatens to further entrench and expand the mass detention of people seeking refugee protection. Rebecca Gendelman, Associate Attorney for Refugee Protection Research at HRF and author of the report, said, as the Biden administration ends the illegal Title 42 expulsion policy, it should not perpetuate the cruel and unnecessary use of detention against people seeking refuge in this country. The government has legal authority to parole asylum seekers and other immigrants. Its choice to detain them instead endangers lives, separates families, inflicts trauma, wastes resources, and punishes people for exercising their legal right to request asylum. The report concludes that the Biden administration must alter course, stop jailing asylum seekers and treating them as enforcement priorities, use its legal authority to release them, and dismantle the unfixable U.S. immigration detention system that violates human rights law. In doing so, the administration should shift to proven case support programs run by community-based organizations and not so-called alternatives to detention that rely on punitive and intrusive electronic surveillance or effectively place asylum seekers under house arrest.
We say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witch hunt.
Turn here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
U.S. inflation is at a 40-year high. The country's national debt has topped $30 trillion for the first time as borrowing surged amid the pandemic. With debt at an all-time high, military spending has not been reduced but increased, demonstrating the utter disregard of politicians for the economic effects it has on ordinary Americans. The U.S. controls about 750 military bases in more than 80 countries worldwide, meddling in other countries' affairs, while the cost of food, housing, gasoline, utilities, and other goods rose by 7.5% over the past year. Hello and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Aria. And in this episode, we'll discuss rising costs in the United States. Why has inflation risen so much? What is the meaning of an increase in the country's national debt? Can the United States still afford to keep its 750 military bases abroad? Who is paying the price for the astronomical expenditure on the military and who is gaining from it? As usual, we're pleased to have our two guests on our program, Todd Boyle, retired CPA and anti-war activist from Oregon, and Ibra Tahir, Republican candidate for the U.S. Senate 2022, also from Oregon. $30 trillion. That's the milestone the U.S. national debt has surpassed this year. The debt is so large that the government has to spend more than the country's entire annual economy to be able to pay it off.
According to the U.S. Treasury Department's recent data, the U.S. national debt has surpassed $30 trillion U.S. dollars for the first time. It is $7 trillion higher than last year's U.S. GDP, which was about $23 trillion. It is greater than the combined GDP of China, Japan, and Germany, and is equivalent to 26 times the combined GDP of the world's 46 least developed countries. To divide it by the total U.S. population of 330 million, each American is burdened with over $90,000 of federal government debt. If the legal tax age is taken into account, each American taxpayer is burdened with nearly $240,000 of debt. In early 1980s, the United States became the world's largest debtor country and has remained so till this day. In recent years, its debt has been growing at an accelerated pace. In the 5 years from 2017 to the present, it increased by nearly $10 trillion. Now, in every 4 seconds, the U.S. federal government debt increased by nearly $100,000. Especially since the outbreak of the COVID-19 pandemic, in just 2 years, the debt has increased by nearly $7 trillion.
The fact is that inflation is a systemic process that's been going on for many years, mostly at much slower paces, except for 1973, 72, 73, 74. You know, I was alive at that time, and the savings of most retired people at that time was mostly in fixed income certificates of deposit and other fixed income interest-bearing things. And the value of those assets was cut in half. So they literally lost half of their life savings, retired people did, in 72 to 74. And then we had another round of inflation in 79, 80. So inflation is very bad. It's bad for people who are savers. But it's also bad for workers. Workers' wages never keep up with the pace of their costs. Their rent goes up and their food goes up and their gas prices go up faster than their wages go up.
Inflation is at a 40-year high. The price of living has gone up and it's hurting everyone. But low-income families and individuals are definitely hit the hardest.
When I used to go to the grocery store, I wasn't as conscious about prices. Like, I would just, if I needed a bag of spinach, I would just grab a bag without really looking at the price as much. And now I'm doing more, like, cost comparison between different brands. So just a little bit more aware when I'm in the store.
I got a truck, so, you know, the gas prices is really high for me. So some days I have to, like, borrow money to get to work.
Yes, prices are going up extremely, and I'll be so glad when they come down. You know, due to the COVID, people don't have money. We just starting back to work and stuff like that. This is outrageous, the prices of the gas today.
There has been some wage increases, but it's by no means able to counter the inflation rate. Some economists blame supply chain disruptions due to the COVID-19 pandemic for the surge in inflation.
Well, unfortunately, so the U.S. government decided to destroy the economy of the working class, but in return there was nothing except for debt, inflation. I'm not advocating for the welfare state at all. I'm not. This is not my position. But this is the consequences of the COVID-19 policies that were put in place. Now, what we are seeing is after the third stimulus check, there is something we have in the country, which is the unemployment insurance. It continued for a while, but now it was ended. But this was only the help that the communities got from the policies of COVID-19.
And now, whether or not that is accurate, prices of almost everything has gone up, and it is making living harder and harder for Americans. So why has inflation gone up so much?
The official story is the cost went up because of supply chain disruptions. So this included, you know, shutdown of a lot of production in China, and it included the disruption of the, and overloading of the ports. which was in turn, that was caused partly by consumers buying a lot of durable goods, anticipating inflation, right? So what caused costs to go up for business is their a lot of their key inputs went up in cost and became unavailable. And what caused costs to go up for individuals was when we look on, when we, you know, the retail prices. Retail costs are up 7% now, I think I read, for the year. I mean, a year on year in January and February.
Now, Republicans are using the rise in costs and inflation to slam the Biden administration. According to a poll released by the Quinnipiac University, in January, 54% of Americans think the U.S. economy is getting worse, and only 15% think it's actually getting better. Poll also stated 57% of Americans do not approve of Joe Biden's handling of the U.S. economy. Is the economy now expected to get worse?
Well, the current hyperinflation, what we call the hyperinflation, is caused mainly by the 2020 spending, which is the spending that happened during the COVID-19. The U.S. government has spent $8 trillion that it didn't have, which means that it needed to borrow money. And the government, when it needs to borrow money, goes to the Federal Reserve and asks them to print money that nobody has. It's not backed by gold. It is a fiat currency that is the main cause for the inflation. Actually, it is the cause of the inflation. So when we talk about 40-year high, we're actually expecting to see more inflation, more devaluation of the currency. And this is the policy that set forward by Woodrow Wilson in 1930 when they acted the Federal Reserve Act. So this is a direct consequence of that bill, of that policy that is controlled by private bankers in the country, which is not constitutional.
The amount of money Americans have spent on their government's ambitious and ridiculously interventionist foreign policy, with different excuses like spreading democracy and defeating terrorism, has reduced the domestic resources so much that the people feel the pinch. The United States spends more on national security than the next six or seven countries combined. This extravagant expenditure comes when the country is having inflation problems and very serious issues with infrastructure and climate change.
Military spending hasn't grown exponentially. It has grown incrementally for many years, actually. I mean, the problem was that it never was reduced after the collapse of the USSR, which was the main justification for the Cold War. But the military spending is not even in the top 10 industries in the United States. It, you know, military spending runs around $1 trillion a year, if they were honest, including veterans costs and other direct costs. And there's at least 10 other sectors of the economy that are larger. So, for example, education spending in the U.S. is $7 trillion or something. It's just huge. There's 10 times the number of headcount as there are in the military. And so we have retail and all these other big activities in the U.S. that are actually larger than the military. The trouble with the military is it doesn't produce anything, any goods or services for anybody. And so it's just money down a rat hole, and the entire military sector is dead weight on the economy.
Now, according to the Institute for Economics and Peace, there is a belief, or should we say myth, that war and military spending has had positive economic outcomes for the U.S. economy. A poll conducted by CNN in 2008 found more than a quarter of respondents believe that spending in Iraq had no impact on America's economic position. Despite this position, the study reiterates that there has been a number of negative economic effects from conducting U.S. wars.
The military spending is taking a huge chunk of the people's economy. We're talking about 56% of our tax dollars go directly to the Pentagon. That's a huge amount of money. So when we talk about the spending, actually, we're not talking about spending tax dollars because we don't have it. We're already in 30 trillions in debt. We're talking about borrowing money, printing money, and raising the inflation. This is what we're talking about. This is how we cover our expenses, including the military. The U.S. government has no limits in spending because it has the Federal Reserve System, which can print money out of nothing.
The study adds that it could be said that if the wars had not happened, taxes would have been lower, inflation would have been lower, there would have been higher consumption and investment, and definitely lower budget deficits. Overall, the well-being of people would have been more positive. There would have been more money to spend on poor communities and more budget for education and health care.
The military sector is not beneficial to anybody except the welfare recipients themselves, you know, the workers on the base, the military themselves. There's several million people who get directly paid by the military complex. And so it benefits them the way that welfare benefits, you know, welfare recipients, or I get Social Security, I'm retired. So that benefits me, but it doesn't benefit society.
Another study published in the Defense and Peace Economics Journal in 2018 showed when military spending increases by just 1%, spending on health decreases by 0.62% around the world. This becomes more important at a time where the pandemic is still surging in America and money could be spent on people's lives and health is being spent on the military. So who benefits from the U.S. military?
Well, there are two aspects of that. One of them, when we talk about the military, actually what is happening with our military is opening markets worldwide. This is one of the reasons. Actually, probably one of the main reasons that we have military everywhere is to control the markets. And when we control the markets, it means it is very beneficial to the economy. So partially, it is beneficial to the economy because it creates jobs. Those weapons manufacturers actually create jobs that we don't need and ethically must be refuted. But this is the reality, unfortunately, in our country. On the other hand, when you talk about the spending that goes to the military, when in the relation with the Federal Reserve and the spending, so we are devaluing also the dollar. So the benefit can go to only a specific segment of the society.
Now, according to the Pew Research poll in 2011, only 8% of Americans believe that there are other countries that are better than America. That has risen to 21% in 2019 and is 46% among 18 to 29-year-olds and 47% for young voters on the left. Now, this attitude of feeling superior to other nations and people around the world has been one of the reasons why the U.S. could sell its war excuses and extreme spending on the military to its people.
It's true that the World War II coincided with the end of the Great Depression because we went into a command economy where you command, half the workers to go and build weapons. So if they want to argue for a command economy, you know, China is a great example. It could benefit the people a lot, but actually it doesn't. You know, this is a myth. So you know who it does benefit and where a lot of the propaganda narrative comes from is from the communities around the military bases. We're like Lakewood, Washington, where half the population either works on the bases or is, a retailer, like a barbershop owner or something, whose sales depends on the base. So no public figure ever really stands up and says, you know, the military is important for our economy.
Now the United States has about 750 bases in at least 80 countries around the world. According to global U.S. military deployment data published in the Conflict Management and Peace Science Journal, the U.S. had around 173,000 troops deployed in 159 countries as of 2020. With 120 active bases, Japan contains the largest number of U.S. bases in the world, followed by Germany with 119 and South Korea with 73. The government spends billions of dollars to maintain these bases and troops every year.
Less well known is the fact that the U.S. has around 800 military bases around the globe. This map can't even show that many dots. These are just 200 or so dots to give you an idea of where these bases are clustered. These bases are everything from massive military compounds to small airstrips in the middle of the ocean. If you combine all the foreign bases that every other nation has outside of its own borders, you get a total of about 30. There's never been a country with such a massive global presence. And the big question is, how did these bases get there in the first place? And how much is it costing U.S. taxpayers to keep them open?
Now, most politicians have completely turned a blind eye to public opposition towards war, military presence abroad, and the ever-growing cost of the military. They ignore it because they benefit from it. Military lobbyists are very strong, and they are large campaign donors. Politicians, they do not care how this overspending has resulted in hardships of many Americans, especially the poor and underprivileged, how it has risen the national debt and also contributed to inflation.
Well, unfortunately, our government is not representing us, the people in the U.S. So they don't really worry about the national debt. They care about advancing policies. And our politicians in general, we call them self-serving politicians or servants of special interest groups. So they are in that position of power not to serve the people. This is why they don't care about actually any debt, how to cut our spending, how to really benefit the people instead of corporations and the upper class that we have. So this is basically the reality in our country, unfortunately.
The U.S. government doesn't just owe over $30 trillion. It owes every single family it has killed while invading their country. It owes all the poor people who have lost their homes and their hopes were shattered because of U.S. bombing and attacks. It owes its own people for pushing the poor further into poverty. It is yet to be seen what the U.S. government is going to do when the people of the world gather to collect their debt.
And now let's check in with our guy in the States, Abbas Montarim, to see what he has to share with us.
Today on Power to the People, we will examine capitalism and why inflation is always a part of the capitalist system. Capitalism is when a few people own and control all the means of production in a society. This means that in reality, there's only a few capitalists, and everyone else who doesn't own the means of production is subjected to capitalist exploitation. This is because everyone works for the capitalist, as the capitalist owns the product that's produced, as well as the company that produces the product. We then sell our labor to the capitalists for a wage or for a salary. And this has created a world where eight men, six of whom are American, control half the wealth on the earth. It's a system where the corporations and their politician lackeys, they control the market and the prices of the goods that we consume every single day. And a natural part of capitalism is inflation. Inflation is when the price of goods rises within the macro level of the economy. It's when whoever is selling the goods decides to increase the price on the good, which then sends a chain reaction throughout the whole economy. Those who control the means of production, aka the capitalists, they control this entire phenomenon. An example of macro-level goods that affect the economy is oil. Oil produces multiple different products, and corporations set the price of its worth, and then this affects the price on everything in which oil is used to produce. And this creates a ripple effect throughout the whole economy. We don't go buy oil from the source. We go to a corporate-owned gas station and buy gas for the price that these gas corporations and that the oil industry decides on what the price should be. These are all arbitrary numbers that these capitals make up so that they can make mass profits. If we look at the Rockefeller family, one of the richest families in the world, they sit in their house, they sit in their office, and they don't do anything to physically get the oil, yet they make billions in profit. Part of inflation in America is these corporations deliberately crashing the economy. The capitalists buy stock when it's low and sells the stocks when the market is high. Then they crash the market, and then they buy stocks when the market crashes, and this price of stock is once again cheap. They repeat this process over and over and over again and make massive profits. That is why it's not a matter of if the stock market will crash, it's a matter of when. And all of this affects the prices of everyday products and creates inflation. We also saw inflation happen through price gouging, which has been happening throughout this COVID-19 pandemic. As this virus infected people, there arose a need for masks, tests, medical equipment, and other goods. Those who make the masks and produce the equipment, oftentimes they decide to raise the price in order to make a higher profit. We saw countless examples of stores on Amazon selling COVID masks and tests at the same prices, when in reality, masks and tests should be given out for free to everyone because it's a public good. But that does not happen under capitalism, as profit drives everything under the capitalist system. Politicians, aka the ruling class, they also take advantage of this. Politicians, they knew the severity of the COVID-19 pandemic long before the general public did. And a minimum of 75 lawmakers, they invested their money in companies that have played a major role in the response to COVID-19. This allowed for politicians to get rich off of having insider knowledge and corporations to get rich because of the increased purchasing of stocks and the market rising. These politicians were worried about their own pocketbooks while stay-at-home orders were on the way and when the masses of people were about to deal with massive job loss and increased poverty. NFL lineman Tyler Crosby, he asked an important question. If as an NFL player we aren't allowed to bet on games, why are government officials allowed to buy stocks and stock options? This exposes the system for what it is. This whole market is rigged for the corporations and politicians. You can't pick yourself up by the bootstraps in a system that is controlled for them to win. The corporations and its politicians, they decide the prices of the market. We have no decision-making power in it. And this is the part of exploitation by capitalism. When the system isn't controlled by the people and it's instead controlled by the capitalists, corporations can do whatever they want, when they want. They exploit the masses of people, no matter what the crisis is, whether it's a recovery from a natural disaster or a virus like COVID-19. If we want to put an end to inflation, we have to put an end to imperialist capitalism. Capitalism is why inflation happens, and we must understand this. This is Power to the People.
I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and make sure to tune in next time when we return with another episode of We the People. Bye-bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Deep insight and firm determination, the most outstanding qualities of Hazrat Hamza. On January 25, 2022, Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, met with the officials of Hazrat Hamza International Conference. This is a part of his speech with the managers of this conference. Among the believers are men who have been true to their covenant with God. Of them, some have completed their vow, and some still wait, but they have never changed in the least. The commander of the faithful quotes the Holy Quran, chapter 33, verse 23. Hamza, Ja'far, Ubaidah are the three people who embody this part of the verse. Of them, some have completed their vow. Well, these personalities are very important. The commander of the faithful mentioned them in such glowing terms. Such personalities should be highlighted, commemorated, and praised. Such narrations show the significance of Hazrat Hamza. From the first moment he was martyred, the Holy Prophet decided to portray him as a role model. The Holy Prophet described him as the master of martyrs. When he entered Medina after the Battle of Badr, he saw that the women of Medina were crying for the martyred.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Four of the martyrs were from among the immigrants, and 68 from among the immigrants, and 68 were from among the Ansar. The women whose Ansar dear ones had been martyred were crying and moaning. The Holy Prophet listened for a while and said, "There is no one to cry for Hamza." When this news reached the ears of Medina women, they said that they would cry for Hamza before they would cry for their own dear ones. In other words, the Holy Prophet encouraged the whole Medina to cry for him. This is an act of creating a role model. That did not only concern the people living at that time. Rather, it concerns the whole history and all Muslims. The work that you two are doing is not only related to Iran either. What you're doing, if you do it well, hopefully, will be a service to all Islamic and Arab countries, and also countries speaking other languages. All these countries must and will benefit from your work, and perhaps the artist will step forward to carry out big artistic feats. Now, what we should do is to determine the elements constituting the personality of Hamza. A great task is to clarify the qualities that gave him such greatness. In my opinion, this is one of the tasks. These qualities should turn into a model for us and for others so that we can learn from them.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The notorious Azov Battalion, officially part of Ukraine's National Guard, their neo-Nazi roots are well documented, as are many of their crimes before the war started, such as the use of torture. Nazi-affiliated insignia remains a common sight on their clothing. Their base was in Mariupol, overlooking the Sea of Azov. They defended it fiercely against the Russians, but lost. Amongst the ruins, some anti-Azov graffiti. It reads, "Death to Fascism," and some more graffiti, perhaps written by an Azov member, it sums up their ideology. Life is slowly returning to the city, but people here will live with what they saw for the rest of their lives.
Yes, I witnessed Azov killing civilians. It was in Kurchatov Street. They were shooting from there, shelling blocks of flats, private houses, everywhere.
Each had three bazookas and a machine gun, and they started shooting. I can't say where they were shooting, because they locked us in the basement and warned if we attempted to leave, they would shoot us in the head. So we sat in the basement. The walls were shaking and they were firing with everything, with those American javelins as well.
Ask anyone in Mariupol who was here during the fighting and they will likely tell you stories like these, of Azov targeting civilian houses and of the use of hostages and human shields.
It's striking that everybody I've spoken to
today here in Mariupol has no criticism of the Ukrainian army, who treated them well, gave them food, helped them evacuate, but that it's Azov, the Azov battalion, who mistreated them, using them as human shields and shooting them, targeting them.
The Ukrainian military have an aim to defend civilians, and they do it. But Azov ignore these rules, and they humiliate people in different ways. Once I saw them pull two women from the streets and drive off somewhere.
This is Konstantin Ivachenko, the new mayor of Mariupol.
We are finding traces of their crimes gradually. In the area of Mariupol airport, there are brutal places. There was a prison called the library, and all people who disagreed with the neo-Nazi point of view were tortured there.
Have you found any NATO weapons with Azov? Is there evidence that NATO has been arming Azov?
Yes, sure. We found Stingers and Javelins. After the city is reconstructed, we will put them on show. We have a lot of them. Lots of Javelins.
While thousands of Azov members have either been killed or have surrendered in Mariupol, they remain a powerful influence in Ukraine, not least because unlike many Ukrainian soldiers, they are ideologically driven to fight the Russians. As NATO weapons flood the country, many of them will find their way into the hands of extremists. Johnny Miller, Mariupol.
It took months to prepare, but it's finally here. Civil servant Sue Gray's report into allegations of rule-breaking parties under the British Prime Minister's roof during pandemic lockdowns. A report Boris Johnson repeatedly told Britons would be a moment of truth.
It's really quite damning because it demonstrates this culture of booziness right at the heart of government, particularly at a time when the rest of the country was in extremis, being locked down. People were dying and not being able to see their relations.
Only a day earlier, revelations the Prime Minister met with Sue Gray at the beginning of the month, allegedly to try and change her mind about publishing her report. And before that, a police investigation that handed him, Chancellor Rishi Sunak, and several others a penalty. The report that blames top officials for breaking lockdown rules also comes in the wake of new photos of the PM toasting his departing head of communications during the second national lockdown, pictures that to many crossed the line. Soon after the report was published, a seemingly repentant Boris Johnson, who had initially told Parliament no rules had been broken, faced the wrath of the MPs.
Well, people stayed at home to protect the NHS. The Prime Minister was engaging in drinking and debauchery that makes a mockery of the gut-wrenching sacrifices that each and every person made. Will the Prime Minister now take the opportunity and resign?
As much as the Prime Minister hopes the country would move on from Partygate, experts say Gray's conclusions could revive calls from Conservative MPs for a no-confidence vote in him. If he lost such a vote, he would lose his job.
Many of his own backbenchers, including Mark Harper, have come out to say that he is not leading as one should lead. He is not setting the kind of example, indeed, the country needs. If the country is in a time of war, this is not the kind of example that will inspire people to follow him as a leader.
Boris Johnson has clung onto power partly because of the Russian military intervention in Ukraine that diverted political and public attention here, and he plans on keeping it that way by expediting a relief package to help vulnerable Britons through the cost of living crisis. Now, whether or not that will help him survive politically is a matter of wait and see. Saeed Pourreza, London.
The spokesman of the Yemeni army, Yahya Sariya, says the country's air defences shot down a spy drone operated by Saudi Arabia with a locally made surface-to-air missile. Sariya says the aircraft was carrying out hostile acts in Yemeni airspace in violation of the UN brokered truce, which came into effect on April 2nd and expires in days.
A combat drone belonging to the Soviet coalition that was flying over Sana'a was shot down and fell here on the Russian crossroad. The Soviet coalition continues to violate the truce, and unfortunately the United Nations has not taken any action to protect the truce that it sponsors.
Local media say three civilians were killed and three others were wounded after the drone crashed in a residential area in Sana'a. In the wake of the incident, head of Yemen's negotiating delegation Mohammed Abdusalam says the Saudi-led coalition is responsible for a possible breakdown of the peace process. The negotiating team says the UN should hold the coalition to account for its actions.
In the face of all these violations and delays in implementing the terms of the armistice, the United Nations must hold the obstructing party that violates the terms of the armistice fully responsible. The United Nations cannot impose the specific sanctions on any of the parties, but it can at least condemn the violations. Therefore, the United Nations must take a positive attitude and condemn any party that violates the armistice that it sponsors.
The two-month truce mandates a nationwide ceasefire. Under the agreement, the coalition must also allow fuel ships to enter the port city of Hodeidah. However, the Saudi-led coalition has repeatedly ignored its obligations.
The new violation of the UN brokered truce once more demonstrates how Saudi Arabia is blocking a political solution in Yemen by its repeated breaches. People here demand that the United Nations take action and adopt a clear stance against the infringements by the Saudi-led coalition. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Rights groups warn that people are dying from lack of medicines in Afghanistan. Afghan Medicine Services Union also says that medicine supplies in the country are running low and that no medicine might be available to the patients within the next 2 months.
Afghanistan is facing an unprecedented drug shortage and a sharp rise in drug prices. These days we are supplying drugs from our stocks and reserves, and I'm afraid they will run out of medicines within the next 2 months. The situation has hit our nation, health sector, and drug sellers.
The union blames the banking crisis, major cuts in global aid, and U.S. sanctions for the medicine shortage. It also called on the Taliban to allow traders to import medicine in any possible way.
Medicine shortage is rooted in different problems. Firstly, most world countries have stopped medicine export to Afghanistan since the Islamic Emirate is not recognized worldwide. Secondly, major amounts of drug importers' money is freezed and banks in New York are not cooperating. Thirdly, the Taliban have imposed certain restrictions on drug imports.
Patients in Wazir Akbar Khan Hospital in Kabul complain about their inability to provide medicines, calling for help from the international community to save their lives.
I am from the Jawzjan province. I have brought my child for treatment in this hospital in Kabul. I have been here for 5 days and I have spent all my money on services and medications. Some medicines are very hard to find and some very expensive. The doctor has given me this prescription and I am wondering how to provide the drugs.
This comes as Afghanistan is facing multiple outbreaks of diseases, including COVID-19, measles, and acute malnutrition. Afghan hospitals and clinics are running out of medicines. Doctors here say urgent action is needed to save the lives of patients. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Donetsk, the capital of the Donbass People's Republic, on a sleepy Sunday morning. The front line is only 6 kilometers away. The occasional boom of artillery or anti-air defense can be heard.
People think it's normal in the DPR, but we have no more patience to wait until it ends, to live under bombing. All my relatives and I are sometimes under shelling. Once a shell flew over my head and killed a woman nearby. It's possible to live here. I was born here, and I suppose I will die here too.
Most of the people on the streets are women. Since Russia entered the conflict, conscription was introduced here, and while the DPR militias have majority support, I've heard of some men who stay in their apartment 24/7 so as not to be forced to join.
Now, to my knowledge, there are no English-speaking mainstream journalists here in Russian-held Ukraine. I think there's a French, a German, an Italian, But that's about it. So in terms of journalists from NATO countries, there's almost none. And the problem with that is that people living in NATO countries simply don't hear the views of people here in Donetsk.
The first thing I would like to say is that the DPR exists because we are free people. We want our own opinions, our own independence and our own views of the world, not the viewpoint that someone imposes on us. So we are defending our interests. That's why the DPR exists.
The majority of people here are Russian speakers with a proud Russian culture. A bust of Pushkin, the famous Russian poet, stands outside the drama theater. And in the main square, Lenin.
In 2014, I was in Kiev covering the Ukrainian revolution or coup, whatever you want to call it, where I witnessed the pulling down of a statue of Lenin by Ukrainian nationalists. Now, if the Donetsk People's Republic didn't exert control in this area, this statue here most probably would have been pulled down by Ukrainian nationalists as well. And it's statues like this, symbolic statues like this, that are important to people's culture here.
Since the nationalistic Ukrainian government took power in Kiev in 2014, they have attempted to impose their agenda on the majority Russian areas, pulling down statues and forcing institutions to drop Russian as an official language. There has also been the killing of dozens of pro-Russian activists. This is what led to Donbass rising up and attempting to create a breakaway state.
Certainly the rights of the Russian-speaking population were stomped on. There were demands that we should speak Ukrainian and not Russian, and all administration procedures were changed to Ukrainian. I think that any culture should be looked after and passed on to young people. It's very important because young people cannot grow up without their culture. There cannot be any people without their culture.
Of course, I was born here. This is my land. I studied here at the Institute. We studied both Russian and Ukrainian. It was normal. And when they started to kill us, we couldn't understand how it could happen, how people can treat their compatriots like this. We are constantly being killed from morning to night here.
The flags of Donbass and Russia side by side. While at first demanding autonomy, since the war, they are adamant they want to be independent or to join Russia. President Zelensky recently said that negotiations are the only way to end this conflict. If lasting peace is to be made, the rights, culture and wishes of the 4 million people here in Donbass need to be taken into account. Chernomyl of Donetsk.
The petrochemical complex of Augusta Priolo is a vast industrialized coastal area in eastern Sicily, which includes one of Europe's largest oil refineries, the ISAB plant. This refinery processes about 14% of Italy's crude, about 10.6 million tons a year, and exports in dozens of countries around the world. Owned by the Moscow-based company Lukoil, the ISAB refinery has been forced to rethink its supply strategy as the EU is aiming to get rid of its dependence on Russian energy following the conflict in Ukraine. Since lenders and oil companies have stopped providing financing and crude to Lukoil after Brussels imposed sanctions on the Kremlin, the ISAB refinery is only left to rely on supplies from Russia.
Although Lukoil is not under sanctions, banks and insurance companies prefer not to work with Russian ones. Lukoil can only process Russian crude. That's why, in order to keep the company running, the import of crude oil has increased significantly in Italy.
Moscow has exported about 450,000 barrels per day of crude to Italy in May, more than four times as much as it did before the start of the conflict in Ukraine, and the most since 2013. Rome may soon become the EU's largest Russian crude importer. This despite Brussels urging all members of the bloc to cut ties to Russian energy. Some unions and think tanks have warned that a total Russian oil embargo would have the immediate effect of shutting down not only the ISAB refinery, but also other large petrochemical plants and many smaller companies in the area. Energy analysts have noted that Russian crude exports have also increased to the port of Trieste near Italy's northeastern border with Slovenia, where the oil is delivered through the Transalpine pipeline to two other Russian-owned refineries in Germany. Max Civili, Rome.
Hundreds of Palestinians attended a national conference in the blockaded Gaza Strip to mark the first anniversary of the victory of Palestinian resistance against the Israeli regime in the Sword of Al-Quds battle. The Gaza-based resistance groups, mainly Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, fired more than 4,000 rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories during the 11-day war. The Sword of Al-Quds battle began when Hamas's Izzeddin Qassam brigades attacked the Israeli regime in retaliation to Israeli aggressions on Palestinians in Al-Quds Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. During the battle, Israeli attacks claimed the lives of over 260 Palestinians, including scores of children and women. Addressing the conference via satellite, the head of the political bureau of Hamas movement, Ismail Haniyeh, warned the Israeli regime against holding the so-called flag march in Al-Quds.
The Zionist enemy must understand that the Sword of Al-Quds battle will be a walk in the park compared to any future battles with Palestinian resistance groups. The Zionists must not test our patience, and they must stop their provocations, especially in Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Palestinians believe that the Sword of Al-Quds battle has united their ranks. During the 11-day war, all Palestinian factions in the Gaza Strip worked together through the Joint Chamber of Military Operations.
During the Sword of Al-Quds battle, Palestinians were united together against the Israeli forces. The Sword of Al-Quds battle exposed the weakness of the Israeli regime. The Palestinian people in Gaza, in Al-Quds, and in the occupied West Bank will always fight for their rights.
Palestinian resistance groups have been holding military maneuvers following the Sword of Al-Quds battle to confront any new Israeli war amid the increasing warmongering rhetoric by the Israeli regime.
Observers say that Palestinian resistance groups fought a fierce battle against the Israeli regime last year, forcing Tel Aviv to declare a unilateral ceasefire. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
French cement giant Lafarge has lost their final appeal and will undergo a high-profile trial in a precedent-setting case which could force Western corporations to stop turning a blind eye to terrorism. Lafarge will be tried for complicity in crimes against humanity in Syria. They are accused of working with Daesh terrorist group for years in northern Syria, with the concrete produced in their factory used in battlefield infrastructure, which terrorists needed to keep the unrest going. They will be tried for financing terrorism, for allegedly paying 13 million euros to terrorist groups from 2010 to 2014, supposedly to keep their factories safe. They will also be charged for endangering the lives of others, for putting its 11 Syrian employees at risk. The original suit was brought by French NGO Sherpa on behalf of the workers.
We were surprised by the decision of the Court de Cassation. And this decision is really a victory because we were a bit worried that crimes against humanity would be dropped. But the fact also that on top of that, there is endangering life of workers that has been maintained is really, I mean, a double victory. So we are super happy, even though we have to remember that it's been 6 years.
After the scandal broke, Lafarge was merged with Swiss giant Holcim, but 8 Lafarge executives will now face justice.
It's the first time that a court decided on crimes against humanity, the first time it's on the mother company for the activities of its subsidiary, especially a subsidiary abroad and foreign workers. It's super interesting for access to justice for victims around the globe. And maybe opening, you know, new avenues for the victims of globalization around the world.
Leaked testimony from the Lafarge executives reveals that the French Foreign Ministry knew the entire time, telling Lafarge to hold on and that everything would work out. The case will likely drag on for years, but longtime political heavyweight and former foreign minister Laurent Fabius may be called on to testify. In 2012, he infamously said that al-Nusra, al-Qaeda's affiliate in Syria, was, quote, doing good things on the ground, and likely with Lafarge's concrete. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
This is IRIB English Radio.